Well, I'm going to talk about something that, well, a paper that Everett wrote a few years ago got me interested in, and as so many of Everett's papers, they get us interested in things, and we pursue them in as far as they want to go. So I'm going to talk about convergent evolution in astigmatic mites as it relates to the certain physical habitats, that rather confining habitats, that many of these mites live in. So convergent evolution, you know, is quite common if we look at different groups of organisms. And it happens when we have species in unrelated groups that are subject to similar selective pressures, and so they come to look alike in particular characteristics. What we see here, these are actually, these are Lipotyphlon insectivores. I like mammals. And here's a European hedgehog. And here's a shrew, okay? And if you go to Madagascar, you find similar-looking animals, but they're not even in the same order of mammals as we now understand them. These are Afrosauricidan mammals, a hedgehog tenrec and a shrew tenrec. There are no true hedgehogs and there are no true shrews that weren't introduced on the island, and so these ancestors of the tenrecs had all of those niches to evolve into. When it comes to mites, this paper that Everett wrote back in 1995, describing a new species of basket mite from a polypore fungus in Mexico, and he compared it with one he had previously described some years earlier here from polypore fungi in the U.S. and Canada. And he made some interesting comparisons here, and the bottom line was that these actually belong to rather different lineages of basket mites, and that they had come to resemble each other in body form because they lived in essentially the identical habitat, the rather confining spore tubes of polypore fungi. So when I saw this paper, it reminded me that I had seen something similar. I have been working on fungal mites for a long time, and this is quite a common carid mite that lives in eastern North America called Belitoglyphus ornatus. This is a mite that is specifically associated with fungi in the genus Ganoderma. This is Ganoderma applanatum, a cosmopolitan wood-rotting fungus here. And as you can see, this is an adult female. She's very elongated. Okay, and here's a picture of it in situ in a spore tube that's been dissected. Ganoderma spores, and you can see them in the gut contents here, are quite thick-walled, and so you can see the rather massive chelicerae of this particular species of Belitoglyphus. We now know several other species of Belitoglyphus where we have ontogenetic series that don't live in Ganoderma in other parts of the world, and they have the same body form, but they have rather normal-looking chelicerae. Deuteronymphs, of course, in this group are phoretic. In this case, here's the deuteronymph, rides around on this fungus beetle whose larval habitat is Ganoderma applanatum. So, having known about this, I'd collected this and worked out its life cycle a long time ago. Then, some years back, I was down in southern Mexico, around the Palenque National Park area here, and lo and behold, I found some Ganoderma applanatum growing in a tropical forest. And when we collected some, took it back to the lab in Mexico City, extracted mites from it. Well, what did I find? Okay, I found this mite that is exactly the same size and shape as Belitoglyphus ornatus. It also feeds on the spores of Ganoderma applanatum. It also has massive chelicerae. And when I saw this in alcohol, I thought, what the heck is Belitoglyphus ornatus doing in Mexico when the beetle that it rides on doesn't even occur outside the United States? Okay. Well, then come to actually look at a bunch of deuteronymphs and other non-phoretic stages here. Turns out this is the deuteronymph of this, and it's not in a carid at all. In fact, it's not even in the same superfamily. It is in the Hemisarcoptoidea, the family Winterschmittiidae, and the subfamily Winterschmittiini, other species of which live in subcortical habitats and ride around on bark beetles and cerambycids and bostrichids. So I thought this is really a remarkable case of convergence. And in honor of this particular event, and just to bring up an unfortunate circumstance in terms of the naming of this mite, it turns out that about the same time that Everett had collected this mite and sent it off to Mahunka to describe it, Gil Ide from Ohio State had found the same mite, sent it off to Alex Fain to describe it, and the Fain and Ide paper came out earlier. Mahunka named a new genus for it, named it Lindquistia. So Everett, in this case, we're going to name a new genus for this mite. And as far as I know, in checking the taxonomic literature, this name hasn't been used. If you know otherwise, let me know, and we'll come up with something different there. So anyway, a rather remarkable case of convergence, because these mites literally live in exactly the same habitat, in the same host. They do the same thing. They just live in different parts of the world. So that got me thinking about other mites in the family Acaridae. The Rhizoglyphon Acarids, you're familiar with, genera like Sancosania, Rhizoglyphus, the bulb mites. And these mites occur in all kinds of different kinds of patchy organic substrates. The mites, the basal rhizoglyphines, tend to be rather large-bodied, rounded like this, rather longish legs here. But we have within the group many different taxa where we have a change in the body shape. Okay? So especially when we're looking at habitats that are very confining, like the spore tubes of polypores here, Boletoglyphus is one of these mites. Other kinds of subcortical habitats, especially wood that is in the fairly early process of decay, where you still have intact vascular tissue that the mites can burrow along, okay? These mites in these situations tend to become rather elongated as opposed to their close relatives that remain rounded in form. So, for example, in the genus Schwebia, here's a Schwebia that lives in wet habitats, not confined, all right? It's still rather big and globose. Here's one, on the other hand, that lives in subcortical tissue, burrowing in the vascular tissue, elongate body, and much shorter legs here. Okay? Another genus, Histiogaster. Here's Histiogaster carpio. This one lives in sap flows and other kinds of subcortical spaces where there's a lot of room to go, in really old, especially trees where you have wounds and the sap flows. You can find these in the bark that's come loose. Okay. On the other hand, Histiogaster arborcygnus, which lives in truly subcortical habitats, has become elongated and rather shorter legs here than the presumably ancestral form. Okay. Here's a genus described by my colleague Pavel Klimov from the far east of Russia called Umakfek. These live in the described species from the Russian Far East are from polypore fungi, the spore tubes. They're elongated like this. This is an undescribed North American species that lives in this fungus here, Bucandra adusta. But we also found a species of Umakfek that is still rounded like so. This one lives in this fungus, which is a very thin polypore, doesn't really have deep spore tubes, and this one lives more or less externally on this one. So once again, a convergent, we assume, because these are separate genera. In each case here, we've got the transition from a rounded body who is living in a more three-dimensional environment to a very elongate body that is living in essentially a one-dimensional environment. Now, these last few years, I have turned my interest more into vertebrate associates. I've always been interested in mammal mites, but we now have the Addio collection in our museum of bird mites, and so I've been doing a lot of work with bird mites because that was the deal. So looking at the Sauroptidian astigmata, the group that includes virtually all of the vertebrate parasites, when we compare what we look at in terms of morphological diversity of astigmatic mites on mammals with those on birds, well, mammals don't have a great deal of diversity, especially those associated with hair. Yes, fur mites have evolved presumably several different times, at least transitioning from a more flattened body to a more cylindrical body. But when we look at birds, we actually find a much greater diversity of potential habitats. Okay, here's a chicken, a drawing from the Avian Integument book, showing all the different sort of feather types that we have here. When we look at individual feathers, we can see that we have veins here with the rachis, the shaft of the feather, the barbs coming off the rachis, in which there are spaces between the barbs, as you can see here. We also, and again, the barbules are interlocking here, and why that keeps the vein intact as an airfoil. On other feathers, we have plumaceous barbs, which form more of a three-dimensional space, as you can see here. And so when we're looking at bird-associated astigmatic mites, we find an enormous diversity of body forms. And we can even find in certain birds very, very a pronounced level of site specificity, even to the point of one species being on like three feathers and then being replaced by another species on the next three feathers, like so. Okay. But now if we're really going to study convergent evolution, we have to do this in a phylogenetic context because we have to be able to distinguish similarity due to homology versus similarity due to analogy or convergent evolution. And so we didn't really have a decent phylogeny for sauropterian mites until recently. Don't try to read this. This is an analysis done by my colleague Pavel Klimov as part of our work on the origin of house dust mites here. And what Pavel did with this is to analyze, oops, sorry, 315 sauropterian taxa, well, including some non-sauropterian astig outgroups, 8,942 nucleotides that came from five nuclear genes, and this was the result here. What we see here is a validation of the basal dichotomy in sauropterians between pterolecoid feather mites over here and then the analogoid sarcoptoid lineage. This tree, as well as a recent morphologically based analysis, is showing that the mammal parasites do not form a monophyletic group, and so the sarcoptoids are being broken up, and most of them do form a monophyletic group, but there are others that clearly have separate origins from a transfer from a bird. Okay. But, okay, if we look at then what this tree tells us about what was the ancestral morphology, you know, what did the basal taxa look like? Well, they look like this. They're rather elongated, they're parallel sided, and they're kind of flat, and this is how they live. Okay, they live between the feather barbs on the pinnate parts of the feathers on a wide variety of bird hosts. Okay. So we can take this as being our kind of ancestral morphology and then look to see what's happened when mites have moved into other kinds of microhabitats on the birds. So, for example, there are some birds in which the barb, okay, that's coming off the rachis is very, very deep, okay, compared to what it is, a shallow barb, in most birds. And, in fact, in some of these cases, these barbs are so broad that they even fold over and overlap the next one. Okay, so these are a couple of pictures of Phryana, a pterolecoid mite, the family Phryanidae, that live on ducks, and you can see that these mites are living flat against these very deep feather barbs here. Okay. Here's another mite in a different family, the Gabbysiniidae. This is from the sandhill crane. This is Pseudogabbysinia. And again, these sandhill cranes are large birds, and they have some of their feathers having these deep barbs that overlap. And again, here's a mite living in exactly the same kind of way as Phryana. Right? And so when we look at these, and I'm putting this one in here too, Phryanella, I don't actually have a picture of it in situ from ibises. And what we see here is a very broad mite, so in each of these three cases. The fact that each of these belongs to a different family within the pterolecoids is strongly suggestive that they are the result of convergent evolution in relationship to living on the same type of deep barbed feather and living on the side of the barb rather than in between the two. Okay. Another kind of specialized habitat that I ran into is especially in ducks. If we look at the covert feathers, the ones that overlap the flight feathers, if we look along the rachis here on the dorsal side, we see this transparent flange that is sticking out over the bases of the barbs. And if we're careful, we look down in here, we can see a little mite down in there. Okay, and if I dissect off the flange, what we see then is these little pockets that contain, in this case, an elopted mite, Brophosphales anatina. Okay. Here's another duck. It's a ringneck duck. Same kind of structure on the feather. You can see the little mites under the flange here, and we dissect it off, and you know here they are once again in exactly the same environment. Here's another duck, the wood duck. Okay, this one I've already dissected. Sorry, the flange here. Come on. And you can see the Avenzoariid mite here, Zygocalypher beeri, in exactly that same habitat. So what do these mites look like? Okay, and I'm putting in here a mite from sandhill cranes again that lives in an identical kind of environment on the dorsal surface where there's a little flange sticking out. All of these mites are very tiny. Okay, they are also very elongated and, with rather short legs, as you can see, Brophosphales, Rectigenua here, Zygocalypher, and Gruolichus. And notice three families of analogoids and a pterolecoid family, each living in an identical habitat and converging on the same general body morphology here. Another kind of habitat that occurs on birds that's different from living on or mites living on pinnate veins are the plumaceous barbs on the contour feathers and the basal barbs of the flight feathers. These mites tend to be rather not flattened, but much more three-dimensional. They're ovoid or even globose sometimes. They have apophyses or projections from segments on the anterior legs that help them in moving around in this now literally three-dimensional space. Here's a pterolecoid mite, in fact, the only pterolecoid mite that I know of that is moved into this habitat. This is Petitota in the family Cramorellidae from Great Horned Owl. Here's the family Analgidae, very, very diverse, living in this kind of environment. A couple of analgids here, one from wild turkey and another one from a warbler here. In the family Sauroptoidae, they all look kind of like this, and they all live in this plumaceous Barbie kind of habitat, one from a catbird here. And in the Zoalgidae, the family that's found on quite another variety of birds, this one on owls as well, glaucalges. But again, you can see this three-dimensional environment. And when we look at them, again, flattened on slides, we can see the rounded body form, the long legs, and I don't know if you can carefully see the little apophyses that are sticking off from the legs here. This one's a bit different looking, and unique among the pterolecoids. But once again, all in three different families of analogoids and a pterolecoid family, who are not each other's closest relatives based on the phylogeny. Okay, so these do appear to be independent invasions of this habitat with the subsequent morphological convergence. Final thing I'll talk about is mites that have gone into the quill space, okay? And this is a habitat that, again, has been invaded by quite a number of different groups of mites that ancestrally lived externally on the feathers. So here's what one can see in a shorebird. In this case, it's a gull in the family with the mites in the family Syringobeidae living in there and making a mess, okay? Now, most of the quill mites actually disperse into the quills through the superior umbilicus. Okay, the superior umbilicus is this little opening right here at the point where the barbs begin to come out from the rachis. And here you can see a picture of a couple of Syringobeid mites actually moving through the superior umbilicus. Now, the Syringobeids are quite unusual in that they're the only mites that I know of that can actually go out the same way they came in. And so Syringobeids, you will commonly find them on occasion outside of the quills, and not just dispersing females, but you can find other stages as well there. Okay? Here again, this is one inside the quill. Here's what they look like. They're elongated, as you can see, either flattened or somewhat cylindrical. String of beads are strange because some of them actually will come and go and use particular quills as overposition sites. Here's a drawing from Dubinin here showing them doing that, filling up the cavity, and then going back into their other quill. The Ascaricaridae are really huge mites as adults. They're great big globose things that literally tunnel up the entire medulla of the inside of the feather and eat it. Okay, this is a very low power shot of the front end of an Ascaricarid. You can see how big they are. But the larvae are the dispersing stages. These guys obviously can't get out. So larvae, long and skinny, right? Very long and cylindrical. And the way that these guys get out is the larvae themselves actually follow the adults, okay, up into their tunnels, and then will make a tunnel laterally, chew a hole in the outside of the feather, and disperse that way, presumably going again into the next feather through the superior umbilicus. The Dermoglyphidae, an analogoid family that all live in quills. These, again, found on a variety of birds. They can eat either keratinized material, as you can see here, or I've seen them feeding on blood from the inferior umbilicus, the feather papilla at the base. Dermoglyphids tend to be, again, elongate, cylindrical, and go into the feather through the superior umbilicus. We don't know how they get out, okay? The Apianicaridae, a very strange group of mites, very pedomorphic. Here's a male here with only three pairs of legs. These have a very strange ecology, and we don't understand it. They only live in feathers that are colonized by prostigmatid mites in the family Syringophilidae. Here's a Syringophilid. Here's a dissected quill showing an Apianacaris here, female, with a Syringophilid down here. What these do, their larvae are long and skinny. Okay? And here's the way Syringophilids go. Again, they go in through the superior umbilicus, but their dispersing females use their stylets to make a hole in the side of the rachis and leave. And they are followed by, okay, you can see right there, okay, a little larval Apianicarid squirming out from the same hole that was made by the Syringophilid. Okay. So let's see. So again, just to compare these things and look for convergences, the body form of the adult quill mites, the ones that are staying in the quill, it can be almost anything, typically a rounded globose or more elongated. But the dispersing form, be it the larva or the adult female, they're always going to be long and cylindrical. So they can go in through the superior umbilicus and either make their own hole or use somebody else's exit hole to get out. Okay? So that's the end of the talk. I want to thank Pavel Klimov for the molecular analysis, my student Maria, who took some of the pictures, and of course, to Everett. Okay? I mean, I remember visiting Everett as a young graduate student, learning a lot from him, and again, he's been a help and a mentor for a very long time. And for all of us, you know, he's showed us how it's done.
We're 15 minutes late.
Oh, we are? I'm so
sure
sorry.
Gonna go
right. Okay, well, we don't need to talk
about
that.
That's great, thank you. Before we do concluding remarks, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for having come and having given such, and to be accurate, entertaining talks. So thank you very much.